Your Honor, the first case on the docket this morning is 2-25-0078. The people of the state of Illinois, Plaintiff Appellee v. Darrell T. Holliman, defendant appellant. Arguing on behalf of the appellant, Ms. Dominique Estes. Arguing on behalf of the appellee, Ms. Diane L. Campbell.
All right, good morning, counsel. Our third panelist, Justice McLaren, is unable to attend this morning. He will, however, listen to the recording of today's arguments before deliberations. So with that, Ms. Estes, you may proceed when ready. Feel free to adjust the microphone as needed.
I apologize if I cough at all, Your Honors. I'm getting over a cold. Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, opposing counsel. May it please the court, my name is Dominique Estes, and I represent the defendant in this case, Mr. Darrell Holliman. Holliman raises three issues that warrant a new trial. I plan to address all three. First, the trial court erred in admitting statements that Holliman made after he had invoked his right to silence. Second, the court admitted other crimes evidence without weighing its prejudicial effect, which substantially outweighed its probative value. And third, trial counsel tendered a jury instruction that stated the other crimes evidence was admissible for its propensity when it was not admissible for that purpose. On issue one, Holliman was interrogated by police in September 2021. He was interrogated on three offenses. In the second portion of the interview, about 18 minutes in, Officer Grabowski asked him about an alleged battery to a man named Wayne. During that portion of the interview, Holliman said, "I don't think I'd be talking to you about this." Grabowski responded, "Okay, you don't want to say anything about that?" And Holliman responded, "No." Grabowski kept questioning. At one point, he told Holliman, "You beat him up." And Holliman responded, "I'm not even going to speak about that." Grabowski asked, "You're not going to talk about that?" And Holliman again said no. Grabowski then moved on to ask about the sexual assault that is at issue in this appeal. He asked Holliman if he knew where Wayne lived or had ever been in Wayne's apartment. At that point, Holliman said, "I don't even want to get involved in that." And on the second question, "I'm not comfortable speaking about any of that."
And, talked about his responses. Each response was he didn't want to talk about that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Actually unequivocally invoked.
Well, Your Honor, the Fifth Amendment...
Is your position that he unequivocally invoked?
Yes, Your Honor. The Fifth Amendment is not offense-specific. And even when the defendant uses qualifying language, like saying, "I don't want to talk about this" or "I don't want to talk about that," there's a difference between the defendant saying, "I don't want to talk about the offense at all," which is what this court ruled was qualified as an invocation in the People v. Thrall case, versus the Lanham case, where the defendant was questioned about a murder, and then briefly the police tried to question him about an unrelated offense, asking him if he had taken a child to church. The defendant didn't want to speak about that. He said something like, "I don't want to speak about that," but the police immediately moved on. Here, Holliman repeatedly said, "I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to speak about that." The reason that the Fifth Amendment isn't offense-specific is that, first, we need a bright-line rule for courts to apply. Second, we need a bright-line rule to govern police misconduct. It would not be fair if, say, police were interrogating a defendant on 10 offenses, and the defendant repeatedly said for the first 9 offenses, "I won't talk about that. Don't want to speak about this." But then gets to the 10th offense and doesn't make those same invocations, doesn't make those same statements. He still invoked. He invoked at the start. That's what happened here. Holliman, well, not at the start. He did speak for the first 18 minutes of the interview, but he is allowed to invoke his right to silence at any point, and that is what he did. He said, "I'm not going to speak about that." Even if his invocation needed to be offense-specific, which there is no case law suggesting that, when he was asked about the sexual assault, Borowski asked, did you know where Wayne lived? Had you ever been in Wayne's apartment? Borowski specifically assured Holman that he was not talking about the battery to Wayne. He was talking about another offense. And Holman said, I don't even want to get involved in that. I'm not comfortable speaking about any of that. He shook his head.
But then the defendant started to ask questions of Borowski, right?
So in response...
He wanted to know, what's the allegation? What am I being accused of?
So when Holman said, I guess initially Borowski asked, did Holman know where he lived? And Holman was confused about the word use of past tense. He was confused, you know, why you're asking about where he lived. And Borowski clarified, at the time that you knew him. And Holman said, I don't even want to get involved in that. Holman did not continue to offer information. He did not continue to speak. He only spoke when questioned. So he was invoking his right to silence. That is different from, I forget the case name, there was an appellate court case referenced in the briefing where the appellate said, I don't want to talk, but then immediately followed that statement by answering the officer's question. Here it's different. Holman said, I don't want to talk, and Borowski kept questioning him.
Should a defendant's invocation of the right to silence be treated the same way as an invocation of counsel? As if to say, so if a defendant says, I want a lawyer, that's where everything ends, right? No matter what's being discussed.
In that sense, yes, they are similar. Although the Sixth Amendment right to counsel is offense specific in that, you know, only the offenses that the defendant is charged with, he has the right to counsel. But yes, in terms of the invocation, yes, once the defendant invokes that right, that invocation must be honored. The police officer shouldn't be in the position where he is determining what the defendant wants to discuss and what the defendant doesn't want to discuss. It's a bright line rule. If the defendant says, I don't want to talk, that's the end of the interrogation. And we do know here that Borowski clearly understood that Holman didn't want to speak. He said...
Holman has a background. He's familiar with the criminal justice system.
He has prior convictions, Your Honor.
And it's apparent from his responses that he knew that he could limit what they were going to be talking about, because he kept saying, I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to go there.
The question is what a reasonable officer in Grabowski's position would have understood.
Right.
And Grabowski did clearly understand that Holman did not want to talk.
But he also clearly understood that Holman had a background, right?
I don't know if Grabowski was familiar with Holman's criminal history.
Is that a reasonable inference? Ordinarily, when you have a suspect in custody, you're going to run his record?
Perhaps, Your Honor. But still, even if we were to say that Holman was only, even if Borowski only understood that Holman didn't want to talk about the second offense, the battery to Wayne, Borowski still kept bringing it up later in the interview. He asked Holman three specific questions trying to get into the incident with Wayne, asking where was Wayne in all of this? Did anything happen over by the liquor store? How did he get into Wayne's apartment? So he kept going back to the second offense, even if Holman clearly stated he didn't want to discuss it. But again, there's just no case law to support the idea that the Fifth Amendment invocation is offense-specific. I tried looking for those cases, Your Honors. I couldn't find any.
Well, the state, you know, it's interesting. The state takes the position that for purposes of whether or not Holman invoked, they're separate incidents. But for purposes of introducing other crimes evidence, they allege that it's all one seamless continuing course of conduct, which is what the trial court ruled.
Right, Your Honor.
It's a schizophrenic argument, right?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
It's kind of a schizophrenic argument.
Yes, to some extent, Your Honor. And Grabowski stated in the interview around the 30-minute mark, when he tries to ask more about how they were in the apartment, and Holman says, I don't want to talk about that. Whereas he says, well, it all ties together. Obviously, you don't want to talk about Wayne, but it all ties together. I have to keep questioning about this because they're so interrelated. for the purposes of Hrabowski's investigation at least. The state cannot prove that the error in admitting the interview at trial was harmless. Without the interview, the state would have needed to rely on J.W.'s testimony to establish all the fundamental facts underlying the offense, that they knew each other, that they were together in that time period, and that they had sex. And J.W.'s credibility was questionable. She had changed the date of the offense from her prior testimony. She was a heavy drinker both in July 2021 and at the time of trial. And she made some bizarre testimony claiming that immediately before the offense, Holman's eyes had rolled back into his head and he spoke in Hebrew. So because the case came so heavily down on J.W.'s testimony and the state would have to rely on that without Holman's prior statements, the state can't prove that the error in admitting his statements after the indication was harmless. Moving on to issue two, the trial court abused its discretion admitting the other crimes evidence. The trial court did not conduct the required balancing inquiry. Had the court done so, it would have realized that the evidence was substantially more prejudicial than probative, and that the state's proffered reason for offering the evidence was pretextual, and the court's ruling ultimately permitted a mini-trial on the prior crime. I do want to note for your honors, I made a citation error in the reply brief. On page 7 of the reply brief, at the bottom of the page, I cited to the Rosado decision. I actually meant to cite to People v. Boyd, which I cited in the opening brief at page 25, so just so that doesn't cause any confusion. In Boyd, the court held that the trial court failed to exercise discretion when it made no mention of the prejudicial effect of the evidence when it was supposed to be conducting this balancing inquiry. Here, the trial court made the exact same error. The court merely stated that the evidence was relevant to prove the victim's subsequent behavior and the defendant's course of conduct. At no point in time did the trial court use the words probative or prejudicial. And it's evident that the trial court really wasn't concerned about prejudice to the defendant. If anything, the trial court was concerned about some sort of prejudice to the state. The trial court mentioned that it didn't want to sanitize the state's facts. That's not the inquiry the trial court should have been engaged in. The concern is, what is the specific probative value of the evidence offered versus its prejudicial effect? Had the trial court conducted the proper inquiry, it would have realized that the evidence was not sufficiently probative for the offered purposes. The state had better evidence to explain why J.W. was too scared to report the crime. And that's the only reason the state offered the evidence, to counter the anticipated consent defense. The better evidence the state had at its disposal was J.W.'s testimony about the offense itself, where she claimed that Holman held a knife to her throat during the assault. And in J.W.'s testimony at trial, she only stated that the assault itself made her afraid of Holman. She never mentioned that the battery that she had previously witnessed 2 days prior to another man had anything to do with why she didn't report the assault sooner.
What are you requesting by way of relief here? Is that this be sent back for the probative versus prejudice weighing by the trial court, or that we do so?
On issue two, I suppose the appropriate relief would be a ruling that the evidence wasn't admissible. I guess I'm not sure exactly if the trial court needs to be allowed to make that determination first. I think there's enough evidence in the record that it's clear that the trial court's stated purpose was in fact pretextual, given the state's argument in closing that invoked propensity reasoning.
The state's questioning.
Yes.
Cross-examination.
Yes, Your Honor. The state admitted a significant amount of evidence at trial that was exclusively relevant to prove the prior crime. It was not relevant to the sexual assault whatsoever. In particular, the cross-examination of Holman was quite vigorous, conducted, went across multiple pages of Holman's testimony, and served no other purpose than to attack his narrative about the prior crime, which he only gave in response to all of the evidence that had been admitted prior. even if the state needed to admit this evidence to prove why J.W. was afraid of Holman, they could have done so with the very brief sentence that J.W. gave near the beginning of her testimony. She stated something like, we were outside, Holman ran up and punched this other man, and then we went to an apartment. That's all that the state needed to offer. Instead, they drew out her testimony. They offered the testimony of the landlord. The landlord didn't even know that they had been there. He had no knowledge. He didn't know Holman or J.W. His testimony was solely relevant to prove that a prior crime had occurred here.
So if this had not come up in the state's case in chief, it's possible the defendant could have opened the door, but what you're saying is that the defendant had to talk about it because it was already in?
Yes, Your Honor. It's possible that Holman would have brought it up on his own, although it also seems unlikely. You know, if his prior statements had been suppressed, he may not have chosen to testify at all. He certainly would not have been cross-examined to the extent he was about the prior crime if the state had not admitted it in this case in chief. Really, I don't know that the state would have had any purpose to bring that up. And of course, if Holman had brought it up, then it would be a case of invited error, you know.
All right, I want to give you a minute to address the jury instructions.
Yes, Your Honor, very briefly. So it's very clear that the jury instruction here was a grave error. The jury was supposed to get a stop sign, and they got a green light. Prejudice should be presumed. That's what this court held in the Johnson decision in 2015. And even if not presumed, typically we assume that jurors follow the instructions. And the evidence against Holman was not overwhelming based on everything I discussed in regards to Issue 1 with J.W.'s credibility. And for those reasons, I think it's very clear on Issue 3 in particular that this court should reverse and remand for a new trial.
All right. Thank you, counsel. You will have time in rebuttal. And Ms. Campbell, when you're ready, please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. I'm Diane Campbell. I'm representing the people of the state of Illinois today. I'm going to briefly address the jury instruction issue. In my brief, I argue that it is invited error. It is defense instruction number one. In Jones and in Petrie, in my brief at page 37 and 38, a party can't complain of an error on appeal which that party induced the court to make or to which that party consented.
But counsel, does that apply in ineffective assistance cases?
I'm working there. Invited error precludes plain error. That is Quezada, which is Illinois Supreme Court. In Legrone, it does say, it doesn't apply in the ineffective assistance of counsel claims. In that case, we have the Strickland standard, and defendant cannot meet the second prong of Strickland, which is prejudice. In this case, the jury found the defendant guilty of the aggravated sexual assault with bodily harm. It found him not guilty of the aggravated battery with a knife. So if this instruction had been so overwhelmingly misleading for the jury, they would have found the defendant guilty of the aggravated criminal sexual assault with a knife, particularly given the fact that he had the ASA actually argued that the defendant's two prior convictions, the armed violence and the felony theft, can be considered as regards his credibility. So that at least was put forth and that restriction was put on.
But it's also argument, and the jury specifically instructed not to treat arguments as evidence, and that was not an instruction from the court. It was an offhand phrase thrown into the closing.
That still does not alleviate the fact that they found him not guilty of the aggravated criminal sexual assault.
Does that mean anything? That the jury may have believed that he was armed, but they, you know,
they were already finding him guilty of aggravated battery or of aggravated criminal sexual assault based upon bodily harm.
I was looking at the
lenity is a, that's up to the jury, even if they believe he was armed.
I was reading through the closing arguments, and one of the points that defense counsel made, which would militate against him being ineffective, is that there was no knife found. And in this case, the jury had all the pictures of the victim's very graphic wounds, the forehead wounds. She gave graphic testimony. The trial judge at sentencing noted her graphic testimony concerning her wounds. So I think that this, definitely it is not prejudicial to have had. And again, that's one of the four, you know, situations. So
she was also a heavy drinker, alcoholic, a drug user.
As was the defendant.
Right. Right. So, you know, in the closing argument, the state actually went into and argued propensity.
I don't believe they did, if you're referring to...
The prosecutor argued that we know that the defendant, when he wants something, he takes it. He's willing to take keys from a passed out man and stay at his place. How is that not an argument that he has propensity for violence?
In the context of the situation, the prosecutor makes repeated remarks about the actual circumstances of the offense. And the biggest one is that he hit her, he threatened her with the knife, he violently sexual assaulted her. When she tried to raise her head up, he slammed her head down again. So the force is in relation to his sexual assault on the victim. It doesn't parlay into a sort of general. And the other...
Well, it isn't saying we know that the defendant, when he wants something, he takes it.
That's a general character saying.
It's an argument about his character. That's who he is.
That is his actions in the sexual assault. It said that the victim testified that he demanded sex. He would not take no. He ordered her to take off her clothes. He violently, very violently assaulted, you know, ramming her head on the ground. She had bruises on her back.
Which he also did to Wayne and took his key. And isn't that all part of that argument?
It is part, but in this case, it is part of the continuing narrative. Hold on a second, let me find that. In Rutledge, which I cite in my brief on page 30, otherwise evidence is properly admitted where otherwise there's no explanation for the defendant's subsequent conduct without that evidence, and when the crime is inextricably intertwined.
Right, but there's a delay of a day, possibly two, between the assault on Wayne and the assault on J.W.
Correct.
I have a hard time conceiving of any necessity to prove the sexual assault of having the battery to Wayne in there at all.
It explains why the victim is so afraid. It's part of it. It's not entirely.
But the victim can testify to that based on the conduct in the apartment. And if the defendant got on the stand and testified that she wasn't afraid, then that opens the door to potentially other things. But
he argued consent. So in that case, defendant is going to, this goes into my opposing counsel's argument that it should have been kept out. But with a consent defense, the defendant is either going to have to testify himself or he's going to have the statements come in. And the trial judge's concern, when my opposing counsel mentioned the trial court said that did not want to sanitize the people's evidence, that's at 351. The sentence just before that is the defense counsel in the motion arguing that the evidence is prejudicial and irrelevant. There is no way in the context of that, that the judge was not considering the defense argument that it was both prejudice and irrelevant. So I certainly agree that this is, and the judge actually articulated that this explains why she was so afraid. So you can't separate out one fact. It's a whole package. Defendant himself testified that he had beat up three Mexican men. And that was how he explained how the victim got the bruise on her elbow. He said he grabbed her to haul her out. And she said he hit her because she wasn't moving fast enough. So this is the continuing narrative of what happened. And that happens when defendant, as according to J.W., punches Wayne, a man, and takes his keys. The defendant knew Wayne. The victim did not know Wayne. So in Smart, that is where the court said that he didn't want to sanitize. That's in my opposing counsel's reply brief at 6. In Outlaw, other crimes evidence, if part of the continuing narrative of the events giving rise to the offense is intertwined with the events charged or explains aspects of the crime charged that would otherwise be implausible. Defense counsel repeatedly argued that it had to be a consensual encounter because the victim did not leave immediately and that she did not immediately report it to Sullivan. When they got out of the apartment and they saw Sullivan. But defendant was still present when Sullivan was there. She reveals what actually happens to her friend when she gets safely away from the defendant. In Johnson, which in that case, in some of the cases, I think in one of the primary ones, the only offense the defendant was being questioned about was the murder of the victim. There weren't segmented fragments, which we found here. And that is what the judge ruled on here. Her full text, I think, is on page 7 of my brief, so I won't go into that. But she very carefully divided. She noted the defendant had given his Mirandas at the beginning. He answered all the questions about the other victim, which was an aggravated battery, I believe. Yes, aggravated battery. As Justice Burkett pointed out, when defendant was saying he didn't want to talk about the Wayne incident, it was always this, didn't want to talk about this, didn't want to talk about that. It was specifically he didn't want to talk about Wayne. Regarding Wayne's apartment, the battery to Wayne did not happen in the apartment. The sexual assault of the victim occurred there. They had lived together previously in the tent city. That was a public forum. Here, the defendant has the victim isolated in an apartment. He told her to be quiet if anyone knocks on the door because they're not supposed to be there. That also indicates why she didn't make outcries or try to escape. He wouldn't even let her go out to get to the bathroom. I'm going to briefly hit the jury instructions a little bit more.
While we're still on that, I mean, doesn't all of this evidence you're citing underscore the surplus nature to the other crimes evidence, that it wasn't necessary for that purpose?
The state does not know what the jury is going to believe. It is going into, everyone admits at a credibility contest, mainly between the defendant and the victim. The state does not know how the jury is going to perceive either of those witnesses' testimony. It will put in all the evidence that it can muster.
And well, in that case, then doesn't the the propensity instruction being backwards amplify that potentiality?
No, not in this case, because the jury found he was not guilty of the, it's the same sexual assault.
Regardless of that argument, there's a long line of cases that say and suggest that the state, even when other crimes evidence is admissible, there should not be a mini trial on the other crime.
Well, I'm sorry to mention this, but this is not a Calderon case. This is the one victim. She was present at both incidents. This is the same defendant. This is not where we have 37, you know, multiple people coming in and saying the defendant beat them up. This is just Julie, just the defendant. Wayne comes in sort of incidentally in this because they have Wayne's keys. Defendant actually was the one that testified that he saw his buddy Wayne, who he had planned to spend the evening with because they were friends, passed out in the street. All he did was pick up Wayne's keys and go to Wayne's house without bothering to take him with him. He took Julie instead. It's entirely reasonable for the officer to, you know, ask who might else have heard Julie in the apartment to counter the defendant's argument that it was as consensual. And why didn't she scream? Why didn't she run out? Why did she stay? That's all the defendant's theory.
Well, if that comes as evidence, then there's rebuttal that could come in. That door is open at that point. But we're talking about the state's case in chief throwing all that in.
In this case, my opposing counsel referred to it as an anticipated affirmative defense of consent. It was a declared evidence, or a declared defense before trial. The state knows this is coming. They know it's the defense plan. They are taking a proactive, they're asking Julie questions to explain what she has done and why she has done it, what she has not done, and why she did not do it.
She never testified that she, followed the defendant's instructions because of what she saw.
Can I finish that?
Yes.
Okay. Her testimony was that she saw the defendant hit this man. He took the man's keys, and then he grabbed her arm and hit her and dragged her along with him to the apartment. So it is, in fact, part of the continuing course of conduct. It explains what would otherwise be inexplicable, which is her fear and terror and why she didn't escape earlier, why she didn't explain to Detective Sullivan. And again, there has to be a clear invocation of the right to remain silent. And the requisite stand for that is the perspective of a reasonable officer. Obviously, the detective here thought that defendant was just speaking. He didn't want to talk about his battery of Wayne.
So it's a separate, unrelated crime for purposes of invoking, but for purposes of other crimes evidence, it's a continuing course of conduct.
And defendant himself acknowledged at R846 to 847, he testified that at trial that he was volunteering answers questions regarding the sexual assault, and that he knew he could refuse to talk to Detective Grabowski, but chose to talk to him anyway. That's the defendant's statement. How can you say it's not reasonable for the officer to believe that if the defendant himself believed it? He demonstrated it later when he asked to talk privately. Obviously knows he can stop the questioning. He can put conditions on it. He just said he did not want to talk about Wayne's battery.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. I'm just asking this when you're ready, your rebuttal.
starting with issue two, I'd like to point out opposing counsel is incorrect about a portion of J.W.'s testimony. She did not testify that Holman hit her. She testified that he pulled her away. The state had, in the pretrial hearing, proffered that she would testify that he hit her, but she did not testify to that fact, nor did she testify that she was afraid of Holman as a result of the prior battery she witnessed. She only testified that she was afraid after the assault itself. Opposing counsel also argued that we can tell that any error on issues two or three is harmless because Holman was acquitted on the deadly weapon charge. I would note that the propensity issue is particularly strong as it relates to the bodily harm charge. Because the prior crime alleged that Holman walked up to a man, punched him in the head, and knocked him unconscious. And in the insta offense, it was alleged that Holman repeatedly bashed J.W.'s head into the floor. The same kind of brute physical force used, not using a weapon. So the propensity issue is particularly relevant to the bodily harm charge on which he was convicted. It's also just nearly impossible to say that the error was harmless in admitting the other crimes evidence because of how extensive the evidence was. And because we really don't know why the jury acquitted on the deadly weapon charge. I would offer to the court, I would be happy to offer a supplemental briefing on what the appropriate relief is on issue two, if the court finds that appropriate. Also, I will, on issue one, I note for the court, the Fifth Amendment is all or nothing. And what that means is that, you know, not only if Holman invokes on the second offense that makes statements about the third offense inadmissible, but the inverse is also true. If this court finds that his statements were admissible in this case, they also would have had to been admissible in the battery case. Because it's not offense specific. You invoke once and the interview's done. If this court finds that an invocation can carve out different offenses, that would be a novel journey in Fifth Amendment law. It's really not supported by any precedent from the Illinois Supreme Court, from any of the federal court decisions that I looked at, or the U.S. Supreme Court. The closest case seems to be the Langdon case, where they carved out, there was this one little detail that the defendant indicated he didn't want to discuss that was not about the offense he was being interrogated on. So in that case, it wasn't an invocation, but here, Holman repeatedly stated that he didn't want to talk about the battery to Wayne, and then when Borowski moved on to discuss the sexual assault, Holman again said he didn't want to discuss it. I would also note, regarding the state's, the prosecutor's argument in closing, specifically, the state's language did go to propensity, not just that we know that he takes keys from a passed out man, but the state also went on to mention, do you think he has any hesitation in punishing her if she doesn't submit? So again, invoking the violent aspect of his prior conduct. While opposing counsel argues that invited error precludes plain error, it's clear that if there's a structural error in an ineffective assistance of counsel case, prejudice is presumed. There's no plain error here. It's ineffective assistance. Do you have any further questions, Your Honors?
Thank you. All right, thank you very much, counsel. We appreciate the arguments of both sides. We will consider the matter and issue a ruling in due course, and we will recess until our 10:30 argument.